In the year 1857, there was a man who was born. And in the year 1776, when he was 19 years old, he volunteered to join the army in order to fight in the American Revolution. He volunteered to fight for no pay whatsoever. And as a result of that, he was given a commission. This man became the youngest general in the American Army at age 19. He was not even born in North America. He was born in France. When he first approached the Continental Congress about being able to serve, they didn't take him very seriously. But when he took his fortune that he had inherited 6 years before and bought a warship and sailed it from France with soldiers and volunteered to fight with the soldiers that he brought, they decided that he was worthy of being a general. Now, there had been some events that had occurred during the meantime. In the year 1776, in September, Benjamin Franklin went to France, and he negotiated a treaty with the French government. That treaty was signed on February the 6th, 1778, and it was known as the Treaty of Alliance with France. There was a difficulty, though. Although this treaty had been signed, the French government didn't seem to be wanting to send anything really to help with the American Revolution. Yes, they wanted Britain to be defeated, but they didn't really want it to be on the American soil. They were preferring that there would be a war with England in Europe. Well, our hero came to the conclusion in the year 1778 that he needed to return to France. He needed to convince his government to come forth with funds to help the American Revolution. He arrived in France in January 1779, and he met with a number of leaders of the French government. Finally, in March 1780, he was able to give a message to George Washington. And the message that he gave was that the French government was indeed going to send 6,000 troops along with weapons and ships in order to help in the revolution. On July 11th, 1780, he arrived with 6,000 French troops. Over the course of the next year, these were what made the difference between victory and defeat in the American Revolution. The man's name was Lafayette. And you may recall that General Pershing, when he went with the American Expeditionary Forces to France during World War I, he said, "Lafayette, here we come." It was the time to pay back for the generosity that had happened because of Lafayette's of loyalty to his adopted new country. But you know, as we think through the events, there was a treaty that was signed in February 1778 that was supposed to help the cause. And what happened? Nothing. Lafayette went over to France in order to persuade his government to follow through. What happened? They dragged their feet. He kept working at it, and eventually the troops arrived in 1780. But the process of working towards this had taken 4 years to get troops to come here to the United States. And in the course of a one-year period of time between when those troops arrived, the war was successfully brought to a conclusion. What we see here is promises that were made, but then it was necessary to wait until they were fulfilled. Now, here is a painting depicting the year 1784. This is after the American Revolution, and George Washington is shaking the hand of Gilbert Lafayette as he is getting ready for a trip. But this man became a general at age 19 and was one of the key people for delivering victory to the American colonies. Promises were made and they were kept, but it was necessary for those involved to be able to trust that the deliverance was indeed coming. As we look at the book of Ruth, and we look at chapter 3 that we're going to be considering today, there are promises that are made. There are assurances that are given to Ruth that she will indeed have her future taken care of. And then she has to wait. She has to trust that the Lord is going to deliver her. This passage that we are going to be looking at, Ruth chapter 3, is going to show a discreet proposal that was made in order to bring about a deliverance of Ruth and Naomi. Indeed, it was a deliverance that brought about the messianic line being culminated through the line of David, as it was supposed to happen. What we need to do at this point, though, is set up for the background on the book. So let's right now do some review. Let's see. Okay. Tell you what. Before we go to the review, let's look at the harvest that needed to happen. This is barley. As you can see, it's a rather distinctive crop because it has a lot of, shall we say, hair. It's called the bearded crop. As you can see, both the word barley in English is related to the word beard, and the word she'ir in Hebrew is also related to the word beard. This is barley as it's growing, and here we see people at a scythe festival as they would be cutting the crop. They're not cutting barley here, but there are 50 people in a line cutting in this field. And notice how that is cut then just is laying on the ground behind them. The crop would then be gathered up into sheaves that would be tied together, and then they could be handled by pitchforks, as we're seeing here with people loading sheaves onto a wagon. The barley would need to be transported from where it was cut to where it would be threshed, to a threshing floor. So they would need to transport it. And then here would be a threshing floor, and you would have horses or other animals going around over the crop as it's spread out across that floor. And as they're trampling over it, it causes the kernels of grain to separate, to be broken off from the rest of the head of the grain. And then in the afternoon, as the breeze would come up, they would pitch the crop up into the air and allow the breeze to blow away the chaff. Now, this is a very important thing to understand how this whole process occurs, because it's in the afternoon when the breeze comes up that they would do the threshing. What that means is you have a lot of threshed grain as it turns dark. That is not going to be the time that you're going to want to haul the crop into your barn. For one very simple reason. What happens if you have Midianite raiders come in and hijack the wagons? You instead leave the crop sitting on the threshing floor. And you have all of the work people, all of the workmen there in order to protect the crop, because the concern is that the Midianite raiders will come in during the night and steal the grain. Remember, we saw in Judges chapter 6 that that's precisely what the Midianites were doing during the period that was in question. They would allow the Israelites to plant their crops, to harvest their crops, and to thresh. And then they would come in and they would steal the grain. The background of Ruth chapter 3 is that there are a lot of people out in that field that are there to protect the grain. That's an extremely important thing for us to understand. There are a lot of people out there. But when Daniel read the passage, you heard mention of only three people. Naomi was in Bethlehem, and she gave instructions to Ruth. Ruth went out to the threshing floor, and then there was a conversation between Ruth and Boaz. And we read, and we get the impression, only two people were there. That is not the case. There was a veritable army out there. All the people that Boaz could possibly bring together to protect the grain would have been present in the field at that time. Now let's look at what it is that Ruth would have done as she was gleaning in the field that day, be going around and picking up what little bits of grain had not been picked up as the people were gathering the cut barley into sheaves. But of course, what we saw was that Boaz made sure that as she went back to her little piles that she made, there were bigger piles. And she kept running into more and more and more barley. I think that Boaz did have a sense of humor. Well, let's now review thus far in the book of Ruth. During the time of the judges, there was an Ephrathite family that lived in Bethlehem. Elimelech, Naomi, Mahlon, and Chilion. They went to Moab in order to escape a time of hunger, probably caused by the Midianite raiders coming in and stealing the crops at the time of harvest. Well, in the process, Elimelech died, and then Mahlon and Chilion married Moabite women, and they were married for 10 years but had no children, and then they died. That meant that there were now three widows there in Moab, Naomi plus her two daughters-in-law. Naomi made plans then to return to Judah because she had heard that the Lord had visited his people. What does that mean? The Lord visited his people by giving them food, as the passage said. The Lord delivered the nation Judah. And Naomi attributed it to the Lord's deliverance, that there was now plenty of food once again in Judah. So she made plans to return, but she wanted her two daughters-in-law to stay in Moab. And the reason that she did so was she thought, well, they would not be able to get married and they would remain widows. And it's far better, in Naomi's opinion, for them to stay there in Moab. But they had become believers. And how much teaching would have been available in Moab? who was it that had led them to become believers in the Lord? I would argue that it was Naomi. Naomi had such a wonderful relationship with her two daughters-in-law that they preferred to go with her to where they would be foreigners in Judah, rather than to stay in their own land. They wanted to go. But Naomi discouraged the two of them, and finally Orpah reluctantly stayed behind. But interestingly enough, Ruth made an oath. Let's look at the oath that she made. Ruth chapter 1, verse 16. But Ruth said, "Entreat me not to leave you or to turn back from following after you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. The Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts you and me." She made an oath, and why is this significant? How was it that making an oath caused Naomi to stop pressuring her? Remember, Naomi saw herself under discipline, did she not? Would she want for her daughter-in-law, Ruth, to come under God's discipline for breaking an oath? No. So at that point, the two of them went to Judah. One would think that Naomi would be happy. She's back in Judah. But as people say, "Wow, can you believe it? Naomi's here." And she would say, "Don't call me Naomi, because Naomi means pleasant. Call me Mara. Call me bitter, because the Lord has dealt with me bitterly. I went out full and I came back empty." Now, although we see her at this point not having a good outlook on things, she's gone through some very difficult things. She lost her husband. She lost her two sons. It's been a very difficult time for her. But right now, she's having difficulty seeing that the Lord is good. That's soon going to change. Let's look at what happened in Ruth chapter 2 from that point. Ruth hit a fork in the road. And the fork in the road was, to whose field should she go in order to glean? And we suggested that it wasn't anything mysterious. She just followed the trail of people who were on their way to Boaz's field. Now, why would there be a number of people going there? Remember, the book of Ruth is written during the, or is describing the time of the judges, when every man did what was right in his own eyes. How many farmers do you think obeyed the Old Testament regulation that Leviticus gives, that they were to leave the corners of their field for the poor to come in and glean? Probably not many. And there's another man in Bethlehem that we're going to be meeting next week, and his name is one that we don't know. The author of Ruth calls him Ploni Almoni, a certain so-and-so. Well, this certain so-and-so undoubtedly did not leave the corners of his field for the poor to come in. But Ruth was able to go to Boaz's field, and she happened upon it because Boaz was faithful to what the law had required. And he allowed the poor to come in and glean. You know, another question becomes, when the Old Testament says that farmers are to leave the corners of their field, well, how big is a corner? And when one looks at Boaz and how he dealt with things, I have a suspicion that the corners in his field were probably a lot bigger than some of the people's farms that said, "Okay, we're going to keep the law, We're not going to do anything more than the law requires. And they have this little corner for the poor to come in and glean. And Boaz probably had very big corners for them to come in to glean. Well, as she is there in the field to glean, Boaz arrived. And he greeted his workers in the Lord, and they returned a greeting back to him. One might think, oh, well, this is just a trite thing, you know, people just saying something nice using the Lord's name, but not really meaning it. But the evidence is that Boaz is a man who seeks to please the Lord. And he observed that there was this woman that he didn't recognize working there, and so he asked, who is her husband? And the foreman said that Ruth was the Moabitess that came back with Naomi, and that she had asked permission and she was working very diligently in the field, hardly taking any time for rest. Well, then at that point, Boaz went over and struck up a conversation with Ruth, and he urged her not to go to any other field. She would have security there in his field. Stay with his young women. And she remarked that his grace was astounding since she was a foreigner. But then he said, it has been reported to me about what you have done with regard to Naomi after the death of your husband. He knew about her selfless devotion to her mother-in-law, and he wished that the Lord would reward her. Well, Boaz wasn't just a man who said, be warmed and be filled. What he did was he invited her to join the crew for lunch. And she had more than enough to eat. And so she tucked away into her doggy bag some to bring home to Naomi. And when she was out of earshot, Boaz commanded his workers to do far more than they had done. That they should, as they would be cutting grain, to make sure and put little piles out there purposely and let her work among the piles that had already even been gathered into sheaves. And it's kind of a humorous picture that I have in my mind, that here she was walking away trying to carry the grain that she had gathered up, and as she has her back turned, all of a sudden all sorts of new little piles show up out there where she had just been, and she looks back and magically here's all sorts of barley there all over again. Well, then after that, she finished up her day. They've finished doing all of their reaping, and so she then beat out about 30 pounds of barley. Now, as we saw, there were some rather wild estimates. Some people thought that she was as strong as an ox, because they had her pictured carrying back 90 pounds of barley. Somehow, I don't think so. But she carried it back, she gave to Naomi the leftovers from her lunch, and she identified Boaz as the one in whose field she gleaned. And Naomi observed that Boaz had not forgotten his covenant loyalty. She could see that he was seeking to take care of them, and her gears started turning. She started figuring out, ho, 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 this is getting interesting. And so she urged Ruth to accept protection from Boaz. Now, we need to look at verse 23 of chapter 2, and we also need to look at chapter 3, verse 2. in order to resolve a little chronological problem, and I call it a little chronological problem because it's no harder than getting out of a paper bag. But it is amazing how many commentaries just get all wrapped up in this little problem, and they think it's a huge problem. Notice that it speaks in verse 23 in chapter 2 that Ruth stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law. Now we look at that, and the amount of time between the start of the barley harvest and the end of the wheat harvest is 7 weeks. And so they picture her staying there gleaning for 7 weeks. Now look at chapter 3, verse 2. Naomi says, "Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? In fact, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." And so they imagine that this winnowing of barley is taking place 7 weeks after the reaping has started. And they're running into all sorts of difficulties. And so they imagine that Ruth does not speak with Boaz for 7 weeks. What we are going to propose is instead that it was the very night that she started gleaning that chapter 3 occurs. How do we resolve this little difficulty? Notice in verse 23, "So she stayed close by the young women of Boaz for the purpose of gleaning until the end of the barley harvest and the wheat harvest." But guess what? She was married long before the wheat harvest started. But it was her intention. Her intention was to glean through the two harvests. That doesn't mean that chapter 3 starts after the end of the wheat harvest. Chapter 3 occurs that same night, the very night that she met Boaz in Ruth chapter 2. Okay, let's now take a look at chapter 3. Ruth has just brought 30 pounds of barley to Naomi. She has also brought to her her leftovers from lunch. Let's look at the conversation that begins in Ruth chapter 2, verse 18. "Then she took up the barley, the 30 pounds, went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. So she brought out and gave to her what she had kept back after she had been satisfied." This is the doggy bag. And then in verse 19, "And her mother-in-law said to her, 'Where have you gleaned today? You have a lot more grain, a lot more barley than I ever would have expected. How did you do it? Tell me about your day.' 'Blessed be the one who took notice of you.'" Now that's going back to what Ruth said back in Ruth chapter 2, verse 2. When Ruth announced that she was planning to go to glean, we have Ruth chapter 2, verse 2. "So Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, 'Please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I might find favor.'" And so Naomi says, "You certainly found favor in someone's eyes. Who was it?" Because she has all this barley. So she told her mother-in-law, chapter 2, verse 19, with whom she had worked. And you notice how the author is building suspense. She doesn't name his name right away. She said, The man's name with whom I work today is, pause for effect, Boaz. So now, while this is still fresh in Naomi's mind, chapter 3, verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you?" The gears are starting to turn. And so Naomi has a plan to seek security for Ruth by contacting Boaz. Now, what is it that has changed in Naomi's mind? What is it that's different? You remember how at the end of chapter 1, she refused to be called Naomi and she wanted to be called Mara because she said, "The Lord has dealt with me bitterly. I went out full and I came back empty." And you remember how she told her daughters-in-law, "You won't wait until I have children, will you? I'm too old to have children, and I don't have a man besides. But just imagine that I had a man tonight, this very night, and that I had twins even. Would you wait until they were grown up to marry them?" What is it that changed Naomi's perspective? Back in chapter 1, Naomi thought that the levirate marriage would have to occur with her. With Naomi. Why? Because Naomi is now childless, right? So she thought that the levirate would have to raise up a child through her. Now, let me clarify the levirate relationship. The Old Testament says that if a man and a woman marry and they did not have children, and the man were to die, that his brother, his next brother, is to produce a child through the woman in order that the inheritance be protected. And Naomi is thinking, "Well, I don't have any children. I've ended up childless, so therefore that she would need to be the one who would have a child raised up for Elimelech. But now she's realizing, wait a moment, I had two sons, my two sons were married, my two sons were married for 10 years, and they both died childless. And she's starting to figure out, Ruth is the one who can have a child, meeting the provision of the law. So she said in chapter 3, verse 1, "Shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you?" She said, "I can now take care of things so that you will have a husband." And so then she observed, "Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not our relative? He would be qualified, and he's taken an interest in protecting you and protecting me." So she said, "I have a plan. And in fact, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." So she hatches a plan. But what we're going to be very careful to observe is that although almost all scholars that look at this imagine that some improper activity took place during Ruth chapter 3, none did. These are two upstanding people here in Ruth chapter 3, Boaz and Ruth. And as we look carefully at the evidence, we will see that indeed nothing improper occurred that evening. Naomi's plan does not involve compromising the integrity of Ruth, nor does it involve compromising the integrity of Boaz. No such thing is in the background here whatsoever. We'll see good evidence for that. But initially, Naomi has a plan to seek security for Ruth by contacting Boaz. Now in verses 3 and 4, Naomi starts to unfold the plan to Ruth. In Ruth chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, it says, "Therefore, wash yourself and anoint yourself and put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be, when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he will tell you what you should do." Ruth is to groom herself. Now, she's had a whole long day of work. She's had a hard day out in the field. Remember, she went out early in the morning, out there with that fork in the road, found herself there in Boaz's field, and she was gleaning, and you remember that the foreman said that she has hardly taken a break all day. And she was there working as long as the reapers worked, and then she beat out the grain that she had, hauled it into Naomi, and now Naomi says, you need a bath. She's been busy working. She said, first things first, take a bath. But when she anoints herself, she is not anointing herself to make it apparent that she's a woman. Because it's going to be important that no one know that a woman had come to the threshing floor. This is not because of anything improper being alleged to have happened, but because there was the potential for violence at the threshing floor, because there could be Midianite raiders that would come in order to steal the grain. So women would not be allowed there. It was not the expected place for her to go. So she washes. She puts on her best garment. This is not a wedding garment. She is going to look like one of the workmen. She's not, I mean, after all, you think, what would Ruth's best garment look like? She was a poor woman. Essentially, as she's out there gleaning, it's like picking up aluminum cans. This is a poor person's work that she is undertaking. What she is going to do is she is going to go out with her best garment, but her best garment is just going to be something fairly ordinary. She is not to make herself known to the men. In fact, she's not supposed to make herself known to anyone. And she better not speak, because she's going to have to lower her voice in order to make it clear that she is not a man. I mean, she is not to reveal herself. But she's just to observe. There's Boaz, and he's eating, and he has a little wine, and he's happy. And so she's there just to observe, not to say a word, not to make herself known to anyone until after Boaz has eaten his dinner, had a little wine. Verse 4, "Then it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies." Very important that she notice where he is so that she can come and lie in his proximity after everyone is asleep. That is, everyone except the guards that are there protecting to make sure that if there were a raid, that they would not be caught unawares. "And he will tell you what you should do." Now that's after he awakens, of course. So there's a period of time between when he lies down and would then be able to tell her what to do. Now notice, he goes to sleep, you shall go in and uncover his feet and lie down. Now, my impression is that Boaz is not a young man. Boaz is probably not young at all. And there Boaz is, and he's not in his comfort zone. He's not at home in his bed. And there he is, lying out on a field, and this is late April, and they're up at elevation, up at about 3,000 feet, and you know what happens in the night? The dew comes, and it gets kind of cold, so there he is with his feet exposed, and he kind of gets a little cold, and he starts trying to figure out how to stretch that blanket back over his feet. And so he wakes up, and he's there, and that's the plan that Naomi has. She figures he's going to wake up because he's going to have cold feet. And so I think Ruth probably has a sense of humor, and she says, that's going to be fun. So she says in verse 5, all that you say to me, I will do. So in verse 5, Ruth agreed to the plan. She said, sounds like a wonderful plan. Well, now we have it moving from being in Bethlehem with the plan being hatched to the carrying out of the plan. So in verses 7 through 14, we're going to have Ruth at the threshing floor. Verse 6 is a summary statement. So she went down to the threshing floor and did according to all that her mother-in-law instructed her. So she obeyed the plan. And in verse 7, and after Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was cheerful, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came softly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. So Ruth obeyed the plan, quietly uncovering his feet as he slept after supper. So she went in. She didn't make it clear that she was a woman. She's dressed up in such a way that no one else has figured out who she is. And Boaz has had his supper. He's had his wine. And notice, his heart was cheerful. He's thinking, isn't this wonderful? We've brought in the harvest. We've reaped the grain. This is a successful harvest. And so there he is, lying down with his head on the grain as a pillow. And you can imagine, there's this big pile of grain, and you have people all over the place just lying down there having the grain serving as a pillow. We've got people all over this pile of grain that are just around the edges of it. And she's to make note where it is that Boaz has gone to lie down. So after he's sound asleep and snoring, there she comes along, and she makes sure that the blanket just gets pulled back so that his toes will get a little cold as time goes on. And then she laid down nearby. And so after a while, Boaz wakes up. He has cold feet. That's in verse 8. Around midnight, Boaz awoke and was shocked that a woman slept nearby. Now it happened at midnight that the man was startled, and he turned himself, and there a woman was lying at his feet. So he wakes up because of his cold feet, and then he looks, and what's this going on? It's kind of like my father and mother would tell about their honeymoon. They got married in August of 1935, and they didn't have their honeymoon immediately, but my father's youngest sister was going to be going to college a couple hundred miles away. So rather than paying for a train fare for her to get down, my grandparents paid my folks to take her down to St. Cloud, Minnesota to go to college. And so they got down to St. Cloud, dropped off my aunt, and had dinner, and my father had food poisoning. So He had a high fever and was rather delirious, and that's he woke up at this one point and said, "Who are you?" to my mother. And you can imagine that she just loved hearing that on their honeymoon. "Who are you?" Well, Boaz, who are you? How in the world did you get here? And so she said, "Shh, shh, shh," and sought to keep it quiet there. And so she identified herself in verse 9. She said that she's Ruth, your maidservant. And she told him, "Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative." When he asked her identity, she discreetly proposed that he become her legal protection because he was a close relative of Elimelech. Now, we need to notice the play on words that is happening here. Notice that she has said to him, "Take your maidservant under your wing." Now, let's look back at what Boaz said in Ruth chapter 2, verse 12. But let's back up. Let's start at verse 10. When Boaz has indicated that he was looking out for the interests of Ruth, she fell on her face, bowed down to the ground, and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" And Boaz answered and said to her, "It has been fully reported to me all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and now, and how you have left your father and your mother and the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. The Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." She has come under the wings of the Lord as she has come to Judah. And he has spoken of the shielding wings, like a mother bird protecting her young. And she reminds him of those words. And she's also indicating, "Do you have a blanket you could give me? It's a little cold out here." What she is doing is she is reminding him of the protection of the Lord that she has come under, and indicating to him that he can take an action here at this point. That is, will he agree to provide the kind of legal protection that it is that she needs, the levirate marriage? Inheritance laws required there to be proper provision so that she would be able to benefit from the inheritance as a result of her husband, Mahlon, having inherited from Elimelech land. And so she is making note of the protection that she desires to have occur. So she said in verse 9, "Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are a close relative." That is, you're a close relative of Elimelech and of my late husband. In verse 10, his response was one that commended her for her covenant loyalty. For not seeking legal protection through marriage apart from providing security for Naomi. Notice what he said in verse 10. "Blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than at the beginning, in that you did not go after young men, whether poor or rich." What he's saying is, you could have stayed in Moab and sought to become married, and you would have had protection, But guess what would have happened to Naomi? And he's saying, you have kept yourself a widow and have not sought to be married in order just to take care of your own security. But what you are doing now is great covenant loyalty because you are seeking the protection of your mother-in-law at the same time. By her approaching him, who's probably older, he is making note, she hasn't even sought young men, people her own age, whether rich or poor. She is looking out for the interests of herself, but she's looking out for the interests of Naomi at the same time. And he is commending her for this. Remember, we have said these are people who are focused upon serving the Lord. How is it that Boaz was introduced to us in the book? Let's look back at Ruth chapter 2, verse 1. There was a relative of Naomi's husband. Now, the New King James translates it, a man of great wealth, of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz. But as we argued, that should not be translated a man of great wealth. It is a man of chayil. As we look at verse 11, Boaz is going to refer to Ruth as a woman of chayil. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a woman of chayil. The virtue that Boaz had is shared by Ruth. They are both focused upon doing things the Lord's way. Nothing improper is occurring on this occasion. There are a number of people around this grain pile because they are there in order to protect it. Ruth and Boaz are quite aware of all the people that are there that are ready to take arms if there were an attack to take the grain. And Boaz is making note here that she has shown loyalty because she is seeking to protect the interests of her mother-in-law as well as her own. And everyone of the town knows that she is an upstanding young woman. But notice, she has made a request in verse 10 and verse 9. She wanted for Boaz to take her under his wing. And notice, in verse 11, Boaz makes note that she has made a request. He says, I will do for you all that you request. What Boaz does here is he pledges that Ruth will become legally secure. I will do all that you request. She will become legally secure. She will have a legally appropriate marriage, whether it is to Boaz or whether it is to the nearer relative. But Ruth is to sleep knowing that she will be secure. He's saying, you will be taken care of. Maybe through me, maybe through my brother. So let's read verses 11 through 13. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. Now, it is true that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. Stay this night, and in the morning it shall be that if he will perform the duty of a close relative, that is, if he will redeem you, that would be a more literal translation, good. Let him do it. But if he does not want to redeem you, then I will redeem you. As the Lord lives, lie down until morning. Boaz here swears an oath. As the Lord lives, he says, you will be redeemed. My brother, the man who is called Poloni Almoni later on in the book, had the right of first refusal. And he said, if he wants to carry this out, that's fine. You'll be protected. If he doesn't, then I will do it. But right now, sleep. You'll be taken care of. Can you imagine how difficult it was for George Washington? When they were fighting in the Revolutionary War, and he knew that this young general, Gilbert Lafayette, was over there in France making sure that the French government would honor their treaty with the United States? Can you imagine what it was like waiting for the troops to finally arrive? Can you imagine for Ruth trying to go to sleep here, knowing that the next day things will be taken care of? But who am I going to be married to? Am I going to be married to Boaz or to Boaz's brother? It's going to be taken care of. What's going to happen? Can you imagine how difficult it was for her that night to do what would seem like a simple thing that Boaz has said? Go to sleep. Just relax. The Lord's taking care of this. I give my word. He's taken an oath before the Lord that it will be taken care of. And you can imagine that for Ruth, this is probably a time when that clock seems to be ticking very slowly. Of course, they didn't have clocks that ticked in those days. But she is waiting for that marriage day, for her security to be provided for. So, she stayed there until just before dawn and was admonished not to say anything about coming to the threshing floor. So, verse 14. So she lay at his feet until morning, and she arose before one could recognize another. Then he said, do not let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. When it says that she arose before one could recognize another, it's saying she rose before dawn, before people could look and say, oh, and recognize someone by looking at their face. So what happens starting in verse 14 is the procedure of getting her back safely to Naomi in order that Boaz will be able to take care of the business in the town and find out whether his brother will marry her or whether it will be Boaz who will marry Ruth. Now he said, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. This is not because they're trying to hide that something improper has occurred. It is because it would be a dangerous thing for her to be going out in the countryside by herself if it were known that she were a woman. She's needing to get back into Bethlehem, but Boaz cannot accompany her. He needs to stay there at the threshing floor. She needs to go by herself, and anyone seeing her is supposed to think that she's a man, in order that she will be safe as she goes back to Bethlehem. They wait until near morning. They wait until after the time that any raid would have taken place to steal the grain. and she goes back. But Boaz does not send her back empty-handed. Boaz gave grain to Naomi, and then Naomi urged Ruth to be content, to wait until all of the details are taken care of. So in verse 15, Boaz gave her grain to take Naomi, and Ruth went to Bethlehem. And he said, "Bring the shawl that is on you and hold it." And when she held it, he measured 6 of barley. You'll notice that the word ephah is in italics. And laid it on her. Then she went into the city. We don't know what the size of the measures were, except I can guarantee you one thing, it was not 6 ephahs. Because how much did we see that an ephah weighed? An ephah was 30 pounds. There is no way that he's sending her back with 180 pounds of barley. Like some of the commentators have noticed, she has many virtues, but one of the virtues is not that she was as strong as an ox. So we don't know how much grain it was that he sent her back with. 6 measures, but we don't know what the size of the measure was, but it certainly was not an ephah. So there in your Bible where it says 6 ephahs, that's altogether too optimistic. Why is it that Boaz has sent her with the grain? He says in verses 16 and 17, in verse 15, there for her to take it. But then when she reports back to Naomi, she tells her more of what Boaz said. She told Naomi all that happened during that evening, including that Boaz would not send her empty-handed back to Naomi. It is important. Boaz would not send her back empty-handed. Boaz is communicating to Naomi, "Yes, I am going to take care of you. I am going to take care of this detail, and what is the simplest way of doing it? Send some more barley." By sending the barley back with Ruth, it's a way of saying to Naomi, "I'm going to take care of this. This is like a little down payment. This is a token of what I plan to do. Here you have a little barley, and in a little while you'll be the owner of the land upon which this barley came." So he's saying, you can have a little barley now, pretty soon you'll have the land. I'm going to take care of this. I'm taking care of the security. So that is why he refused to send her back empty-handed. But again, in verse 17, it's not 6 ephahs of barley. It's a much smaller amount, but enough to make it clear that he is going to take care of her. As a result of all that Naomi has heard, and as a result of seeing the imagery of having the barley sent, knowing that she's going to own the land as well, Naomi urged Ruth to be content, knowing that Boaz would diligently ensure that she would become legally secure. She's saying, "Just wait. It'll all be taken care of. Just wait. Wait on the Lord. It will be taken care of." Verse 18. Then she said, "Sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out. For the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day." That's the hardest thing to do, is it not? To sit there and to wait for something to be taken care of that you can't even help. You just have to wait. Notice how Ruth has been put into that position. she was told, go out to the field and don't be in a rush to make yourself known to the men. Wait until he's had dinner. Wait until he's had wine. Wait until he goes and finds a place to lie down. Make sure you know where it is so you don't have to find him in the dark. Wait until he goes to sleep. Go find a place nearby, close enough that he can let the dew hit his feet and wake him up. And wait until he wakes up on his own. Don't wake him up. And there she is, having to wait until midnight until finally his feet get cold. And then just let him tell you what you're supposed to do. What did Boaz say? I'm a near relative, and I'll do all that you request, but I'm not the closest relative. We have to find out tomorrow whether my brother will redeem you. But if he doesn't redeem you, I'll redeem you. And then sleep. Just wait. Just wait until morning. And then he sends her back, not empty-handed. She has the grain. She tells Naomi everything that happened, gives her the grain. And what does Naomi say? Wait. Now, can you imagine how difficult it is here for Ruth to follow all that's being said? Because everyone's saying, just wait a little while. Just wait a little while. The Lord will take care of it. And oaths are being made, promises are being made, and faithful people are following through on what the Lord has provided. It is very much like that which happened back in the time of the Revolutionary War. Between the time that Benjamin Franklin went to France in order to negotiate for the French to help in our revolution, it took 4 years for the promise to be carried out. Gilbert Lafayette was instrumental in bringing the fruition of the promise, of having it be kept. But God is faithful here, as we have seen in Ruth, to make sure that the promise is kept. And Ruth is needing to wait on the Lord to see that promise being kept. Doesn't this remind us of James? Where James says, count it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be mature, complete, lacking in nothing. Sometimes the hardest thing is to wait on the Lord when he's working during the trial. Because we get in the midst of the trial and we want to hurry up and get it all accomplished. But notice how the Lord was working to bring about the deliverance of Ruth and Naomi through it all. The Lord was faithful. And we can see that easily by hindsight as we look at the passage. But when we get into our own lives, it's hard for us to wait on the Lord. But the Lord is faithful and he keeps his promises. And we need to remember that as we enter into trial. The Lord brought about a deliverance for Ruth and for Naomi, and he brought about the line through whom David would come, that he would become king, and through which Jesus Christ could be our Messiah, the one who keeps his promise to us of everlasting life for those who simply believe his promise of everlasting life to them.